at a terrible disadvantage behind these podia, which were designed by men, I think, very tall men, sort of disappear back here. The study that we're doing is pretty complementary to what Dan is doing. We've got a very eclectic group here. Michael is a parent coordinator, clinical psychologist, and divorce researcher in Boston, with very little domestic violence background, which he's getting very quickly. Marjorie Fields is a former family court and Supreme Court judge who left the bench because she wanted to become a lawyer in private practice, advocating for families in which there was domestic violence in custody cases. And Kim Susser has been our savior. She's the one who sort of instigated the study by saying, we're having a real problem with our cases in family court and with the evaluators. So that was sort of the basis for starting this. And April is a custody evaluator in New York City who's a consultant on the project. Sorry, too close. And then we have people from various agencies in New York City who have cases in family court who, these are mostly, they represent victims of domestic violence, primarily women, in contested custody cases, and only indigent clients, so they're free legal services. Okay, this is a really difficult area. I don't know how judges stand it. I hope to hear from Judge Koch. How is a judge to know what's going on in a family, and how can you tell from how they present themselves in court who's a good parent? So it's really an impossible task to begin with. And then you add to it a domestic violence allegation, and how do you know if that's really going on? So they rely a lot on custody evaluators. And then what did the custody evaluators do is really the question for this study. And we've got two different contexts for these cases. The legal context puts the best interest of the child first, parental rights second, and then they have to factor in the impact. In New York State, it's a factor, in some states, a presumption that a parent should not get custody if they're perpetrating domestic violence. And then there's the social clinical context of, you know, what happens to the child in these situations if the parents are fighting just to begin with. If there is domestic violence, the custodial parent has to be safe in order to provide a good home for the child, and domestic violence has an impact on parenting as well. So we've got these two dynamics going on. The custody battles set up one set of dynamics. In divorce, there's a lot of conflict. It's a time when evaluators and judges might suspect that one party will make false allegations of domestic violence. There may be violence that's just due to the heightened emotions around the time of separation and fighting over custody. And then there's the issue of whether one parent is trying to turn the children against the other parent. And then we've got the dynamics of intimate partner violence, which may make the same actions look very different, or the same scenario look very different. Maybe there's violence at the time of separation, not because it's of the heightened emotion, but because abusers escalate their violence when they feel they're losing control. So the same behavior can look very different. One of the things we looked at is evaluators' perception of the causes of domestic violence and whether that influences how they interpret the situation and what the risks are. And then drug and alcohol abuse is another factor that can influence the dangerousness of the situation, how the evaluator or the court perceives each parent. So we have a huge list of research questions. We also have a huge data set. These are the questions we're looking at. I'll try to go through this fairly quickly. These are all the factors that might be considered. What do evaluators look at? The impact on the child of the domestic violence history, the parenting. Whom do they interview? Do they interview just the family, or do they go outside and they interview neighbors, teachers, family members on each side? How do they interview the parents and children together, separately? Do they interview the kids as a group? What do they ask them? What do they ask the kids? How do they go about it? Do they do it through with children? Are they doing stories and pictures, or are they just asking them outright, does your mother beat your father? Does your father beat your mother? And do they use psychological tests? I'm not going to go over that because our findings are very similar to Dan's. They use the MMPI and the Rorschach. They don't really rely on it very much. What weight do they give to the different sources? There's enormous records, criminal court records, family court records. Are they looking at it? Do they think it's informative? Do they recommend a parenting plan? In New York, they're not supposed to, at least in the city. The judges are supposed to be making the decision. They're just supposed to, you know, do a sort of clinical portrait of the family. In fact, they do. If they're instructed by the judge not to present a parenting plan, they'll just make their conclusion so obvious the way it should go. So this is sort of not worked as a solution to putting it back on the judge. And they all recommend treatment. They are clinicians. So we're looking at some of these same factors. Are they knowledgeable about domestic violence? Does their basic theoretical orientation influence the way they go about evaluating? What do they think about parental alienation? What do they think about the importance of maintaining a relationship with each parent, no matter how lousy they are? Oops, skipped one. So our method was we got 70 cases through these legal assistance agencies in which domestic violence was alleged and there was a forensic evaluation. We got enormous case files, and we had staff of the, we were not allowed to see them as researchers, but we got staff of the agencies to go through these huge files and create a database with all the factors in the case. So there might be divorce proceedings, what happened. There might be, you know, 10 family offense petitions in family court or Supreme Court. In New York State, Supreme Court is the divorce court, basically. So we have this big data set of 300 variables on each case. Then we got the redacted evaluation reports, which range from, you know, shortest is probably 20 pages, and they go up to 50 pages. So we have these huge stacks, and for each case, we got the evaluation report, we got the order appointing, this is sort of in reverse order, the judge's order appointing the forensic, because they might direct them to look for certain factors, investigate whether there is domestic violence, investigate whether there's parental alienation, interview multiple people, get all the records, or it might just say, interview the parties, and keep it very simple. So what we can't judge the evaluator on what they did if we, without looking at the order. And then we got a copy of the final order. And in addition, we're interviewing some evaluators from these 70 cases and giving them a brief survey. And we're also looking at their CVs to look at their background and training. With the interviews, we're going to try to match it up to whether what they say they do looks like what they do. Okay, we have just preliminary findings also. We have the kind of data, but we're sort of beginning the analysis. The attorneys, this is a cognitive salience issue, the attorneys thought they had, these cases happen all the time, where there's a forensic evaluator and there's domestic violence allegation. In fact, it's quite a small percentage of their cases. And we also found that this sample we got from these legal service agencies were a little bit biased to the positive because they tend to get the evaluator they want. So these horror cases that they have are the minority of our sample. So it's a little bit of a distortion. And basically what we know from the interviews is that the evaluators, there's no standard. They all think they're different. They don't know what anybody else does. They all perceive their job differently. Although most of them, I think there's just one exception, is they think their job is to figure out if the allegations are true. And that's really what they think they're doing. So one said, I'm really a detective. So they're sort of amassing the evidence through interviews, through record reviews. And then they really want to tell the judge what the custody and visitation order should look like. And basically we found just a preliminary review that they all think they're different. I do it differently from everybody else, even if they do it the same. No matter what their beliefs are, they're all pretty conscientious when they get in there. They tend to end up looking pretty much alike, regardless of. You know, there was one man who said, "Oh, there's a domestic violence expert. I hate them. You know, they make such a big deal out of this. A little slap. What does it matter? That's not domestic violence. You know, psychological abuse, not a big deal." Yet when you look at his evaluations, he's pretty thorough, and he's just as likely as one who says, "Oh, there's so much domestic violence, and you know, I believe most of the allegations." They're equally likely to find domestic violence or not in the cases that we look at that they did. So that's a little bit reassuring. But the biggest difference we found so far is that some of them take a very clinical approach. They don't look at any records. They just do interviews. And they just do their clinical interviews and Rorschach tests and projective tests. And they really think they can get at the truth that way, and they don't need to look at any records, whereas others just spend enormous amounts of hours going through every petition, and try to look for an overall fact pattern, which is sort of not a clinical psychologist's job. But, so that's the biggest difference. So I have a handout, probably not enough, with the statistics, and I want to just talk about a case to sort of illustrate all the issues. And this case was very typical in a lot of ways, but it was atypical in the fact that there were three different custody evaluators on it. It just sort of shifted around, and they came up with different conclusions. So I wanted to show how their approach led them to different conclusions about what was going on in the family. And custody kept shifting back and forth depending on which evaluator held sway over the judge at that moment. And that's sort of mystery, too. Okay, here's the mother. This is kind of typical. In a way. And the part about her husband trying to, you know, kill the district attorney in a prior case is not typical, but this sort of education class disparity between the father and mother is quite common. She had a learning disability, dropped out of school, got married, and had a child. Her husband ended up in prison. She went to prison briefly as an accomplice, was on probation for 5 years. She met the father in this case, and he helped her win a custody battle with the father of her son, who was in prison. And they had two children together. They never married. And then she began to say he was abusive and controlling. And he was quite educated, quite self-aggrandizing, claimed all these heavy connections, like, he'd worked in the Manhattan DA's office, or he'd done this and he'd done that. He claimed he knew all the jazz greats because he'd been a jazz musician. He described himself as a health nut, and it was quite extreme. He boiled water for 5 minutes before he drank any, or cooked in it. But he also saw himself as helping this woman. He was going to get her through high school, get her through college. So that was part of his sort of controlling perfectionist personality. He was arrested for physical assault on the mother twice. The first time it was what we call ACD in New York. It's basically if he follows these conditions from the court, the case will be dismissed. So he was told to go to an anger management program. If he went to the anger management program, the case would be dismissed, but he never went. Nobody followed up, and the case was dismissed. But the mother got an order of protection. And she eventually signed an agreement with him saying that she wanted to reconcile and she wouldn't press charges against him. So they were back together. And then he was arrested for another assault. He pled guilty. And there don't seem to be any penalties associated with that guilty plea, except that she got another 1-year order of protection. So the family split up. He had to move out. She kept the apartment. She got a new boyfriend. He moved to the suburbs, got a house. She had custody. Father had them on weekends. They had to go to a precinct to exchange the kids. The father took the kids to a therapist. He also, after the second arrest, he took them to a hospital, to the emergency room, on the grounds that the mother was abusing them when she had them. She strangled the older son. She was beating the younger, the two girls. So he went to court. The mother went to court. Her attorney left because he didn't think anything was going to happen that day. So she was unrepresented. He testified that he had hospital records showing that she was abusing the kids. In fact, the kids were seen by a doctor and a social worker, and they said nothing happened to these children. But he got up there and claimed it, so the judge yanked the kids, put them with the father. The mother still had unsupervised visitation on weekends. This is sort of a mystery. So that was in November. December, ACS is the Child Protective Services Agency in New York City, and the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children both did investigations. They found no child abuse. They recommended returning the children to the mother. The law guardian who represents the children in court recommended returning the kids to the mother. The father hired a forensic evaluator. So the first therapist that the father took the kids to, I'm calling Dr. A. The second the evaluator hired by the father, I'm calling Dr. B, just to keep them in order. He found child abuse and recommended the children remain with the father, so the judge said the kids are going to stay with the father. Then the mother hired a forensic evaluator, and she found no child abuse, did lots of tests on the mother, found she was average intelligence, and found she was fine, and recommended custody go back to the mother. The judge ordered the kids to stay with the father, but increased her visitation. In March, the court appointed an evaluator, produced a report in July. And this evaluator did a really thorough review, found that the father had engineered this claim of abuse, said the kids had to go right back to the mother. They moved out to the suburbs. They were in a different school. They'd been with the father for 9 months. She said it's summer, good time to put them back in their old school in the city with the mother. And then she said, well, the father's done all these terrible things, but the kids are really attached to him, especially the son whose father was in prison. He'd become very attached to this. He had a lot of issues and was very attached to this guy. So in the end, it took another year or 2 years. They finally settled with custody with the mother and the father having liberal visitation. So isn't that scary? I mean, I put down a couple of reasons it's scary, and if we had more time, I think there are about five reasons it's scary. But these are my first two. How did they, all these educated evaluators, you know, the three of them were clinical psychologists with PhDs. One of them was a clinical social worker. How did they look at this family and come up with such different conclusions? And the other thing that I thought was scary is if the court really abused the mother, had strangled the son and was beating the girls, why is she having unsupervised visits all weekend? And then there are a few more. So how did it happen? These are the factors that I think influenced, and I'll go through it with each one. And these are the typical features. What's most typical about it is there are two different stories. And who to believe? You know, is the mother abused by the father and he's alienating the kids against her, or is she making this stuff up and she's really abusive and dangerous to the kids and he's the better parent? How do you know? Okay, the therapist hired by the father saw all three kids together. They were 8, 6, and 4. So one of the criticisms of Dr. D, the court-appointed evaluator, was you don't see kids at these different developmental stages with different parents and different issues. You shouldn't be treating them together. And that sort of gave the kids a chance to present this united front and talk about what the mother had done to them, and the father's paying the therapist, which is another issue. The evaluators we interviewed said they really believe the Child Protective Services, that they do, on the whole, good investigations. Yet that didn't prevail in this case. They did pretty well. They interviewed the children, the mother, the neighbors. Two of the neighbors were friends of the father and said, you know, he never abused her, but she did abuse the children. Shoot, 5 minutes. I thought you were going to tell me halfway. Okay, rushing along. Okay, the court-appointed evaluator did a really thorough investigation. By now, the case file was this thick. Looked at everything. Looked at the documents. Dr. B, the evaluator hired by the father, only interviewed the children. So one of my conclusions, just to jump ahead a little bit, is relying on these clinical interviews can work very well. Some of these clinicians are amazing at teasing out the truth from the kids, and they're very clever. They do things like they show photographs of the family, you know, that they got from the mother or the father. Well, this doesn't look like what you're describing to me. But others are terrible. They just ask outright, and they get whatever the parent has told them, and they don't seem to be suspicious when the kid is using language that isn't really appropriate for their age, so obviously they're rehearsed. So on the whole, I think it looks better if they really do the investigation, even though the judges say they're not supposed to. There are all these documents available. Here's what they actually look at. You know, some of them, the majority, are not really looking at these records, which is a problem. How do they determine the truth, consistency, if they can do a good interview with the kids? Timing can influence whether they think it's false. I can't do this. They look what they look for to see if it's dangerous. Parental alienation is so controversial, and I came into this with my own set of, we don't use that language. This is a myth. There's no way around it. It's going on in these cases all the time. Some of the kids are coached to say things like these three children. Mom strangled me. In the end, when the final evaluator did the interviews, the kids said different things each time she saw them three or four times. Each time the story was different. Mom lies, dad lies, he hits us, she hits us. So it went back and forth, and it really was clear there wasn't much going on there. They were very confident in their conclusions. This is a little disturbing because they really can be wrong. And there's a much more egregious case where the judge followed the evaluator, and the evaluator was clearly wrong. Okay, the evaluator is a key person. Judges don't often enough, I saw it a few times, where the judge said, the evaluator said there was no domestic violence here. And the judge said, there's a medical record, I'm giving custody to the mother, you know, I'm going to put protections in place. The evaluators complain that the judges don't read their reports. They really need to read them, but read them skeptically and look at the methodology. Okay, I've already said all this. Sorry, I'm 3 minutes. Oh, good, I'm on my last few slides. I think the judges should specify the scope of the evaluation and not limit it to just do interviews, because they're just a single interview especially, but sometimes multiple. It's just not enough. Some of these evaluators know nothing about domestic violence. There was a case where a psychiatrist interviewed all three parties and said the mother's allegations were bizarre. They were actually fairly typical. She asked the father. He said, no, this never happened. And she said, well, there it is. So she gave custody to the father. And the mother had no visitation because she thought she was fabricating the fact that the father kept her captive and that the father looked at pornography and was sexually abusive to her. She said, this doesn't happen. The psychiatrist said. So read the reports and question those conclusions. We still don't know what's best for kids. In this sample case I was talking about, the father had alienated the kids from the mother, gotten them to make these accusations. Nobody knew what to do about that because the kids really needed him and they were very attached to him. So they sort of had no way to deal with that. They were going to go on spending a lot of time with him, even though he was going to continue to try to turn the kids against the mother. And we don't know what to do, so we need further research in these areas. And really, there should be more follow-up, everybody says. They have to be brought back to court. They have to need follow-up evaluations. Is it working? And what's going on, and what are the developments, and can we now see the picture better now that we're, you know, like a year away? And is it safe for the kids? Okay. So I had quantitative data that I put into the handout, but I think Judge Koch is going to talk about it.